The lecture will be about Chanukah, Purim, Yom HaOtzmaut, Tisha B'Av, and Yom HaShoah. When you look at these days, what do they all have in common? I mean, when I just list them up, you would say, oh dear, that will be a long lecture. Actually, it won't, because they all have a lot of things in common. When you see these names, what would you say do they have in common compared to everything you learned so far?
You're allowed to work on these days.
Yeah, for example?
Yes.
No.
No lunch break.
They're
you
all chagim that has nothing to do with a biblical event.
No, and I don't agree with everything with everything you said. You said they are all chagim. No, none of them is a chag. None. No, they are not festivals. They are weekdays. And you said none of them is connected to the Bible? Wrong. Purim is.
In Tisha B'Av in some way.
In some way, right. Tisha B'Av also.
Mm-hmm.
There's
an historical event and not a religious.
Yeah, they all commemorate some historic event. Related somehow to the people of Israel, or to the land, or to the temple. But the most important for us liturgically is they are all weekday services, except Chanukah, which could be part of it, is a Shabbat, of course, because Chanukah is so long. But the rest are weekday events.
They try to give us one lesson.
Yeah.
It's a lot
more
than that.
That's
the next slide.
To present them to you, I sorted them a bit. You can sort them in many different ways, but to make it easier for you to listen, I grouped them so that we can deal with them in blocks. One block is these three. They are weekday services, but with small insertions into the Amidah. So it's not a complete normal weekday service, but the weekday has something special. Not a big insertion. Al Hanisim is a prayer which you insert into the Amidah. These two have a Megillah, a special reading from the Ketuvim. So in Purim, you all know we read Esther, the Megillah. But also on Tisha B'Av, we have a Megillah which is Echa, or Lamentations. Much later, in medieval times, people thought there should also be a Megillah on Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot, but that's much later and that's for a different reason. So here are the real Megillot, here do they belong to. And these two have in common that they are quite recent death events. And yesterday when we talked about Yizkor, and Eli said that in the end of the 19th century something crystallized. So it was in the beginning, it was very many customs, and then in the course of the time, people agreed to use this in it. At the moment, with these two days, we are in the beginning period. So there are many, many different ways to commemorate these days. And perhaps when you hear a lecture in 100 years, they would say, well, in the middle of the 21st century, it was agreed. But we are at the beginning of creating new liturgical expressions. These are events which commemorate somehow the temple. It's not only Tisha B'Av, but it's some other days as well, which we don't observe in the liberal tradition.
Is Chanukah also temple?
Right, Chanukah could be...
It's not a fast day.
But it's temple related, yeah. In the congregation, when I lived in Berlin, in my congregation there, all these days, except Chanukah, had aspects of Yom HaShoah. Because on Purim we celebrate that we survived, on Tisha B'Av we remember catastrophes. Yom HaAtzmaut is, again, after the catastrophe we have the land. And then there were many, many local memorials, so that the year was very much dominated by memories, commemorations of the Shoah. Now that I'm in England, it's surprising. It doesn't play such a big role. And each festival has its own character. Each day has its own character. So let's start with the first column, Chanukah Purim Yom HaAtzmaut. Yes, yeah, so that I understand. The Bible is yours. Purim is based on a biblical story, and in the Bible, in Esther 9:30-31, it is said we should commemorate that day, and the day is set on the 14th of Adar, and remember that it was planned to kill all the Jews in Susa, in Shushan, in that city, but you know the story, I don't have to tell you, and you'll hear it in 8 days anyway. Purim is mentioned in the Megillah, in the Mishnah. There's a tractat Megillah, which says you should read the Megillah on Purim. You should hear it, actually, not read, hear it. And there are a lot of halachical issues connected to it. For example, that you should hear the Megillah. Then there are certain other issues which I won't deal with now, but you see the three dots are, of course, there's much more to say. But it does belong to this context here. What you should know from a liturgical point of view, and that's what we are focusing on here, is that Purim has an influence on the calendar. The day after Purim is Shushan Purim, where Purim is in Jerusalem. If you have friends there, you will realize that they have Purim on another day. That's because Purim should be celebrated on that day because it had walls at the time of Yehoshua. So Jerusalem is such an old city. And in cities which had walls at the time of Yeshua, Purim is on another day.
It's a problem what you do with Jericho. Had walls, but they didn't.
Traditionally, I think this is also not the practice in the liberal Jewish tradition, you have a fast day before Purim. So these are not important aspects, but now come... Yeah? Because in the book of Esther, it said that the people, what's the verse, that on the day after Purim, they continued to revenge to the killing. And, yeah. So that's in the Megillah. Listen to the Megillah next but 1 week. It's mentioned there. The Shabbat before Purim. So it's actually this Shabbat. This is Shabbat Zachor. And you read on that day that we should not remember Amalek. This is connected to Purim because Amalek, Haman was from the tribe of Amalek. So he was remembered. King Shaul left someone alive, someone stayed alive from the family of Amalek, and that was the predecessor from Haman. So you see the consequences when you don't take Amalek serious to destroy him. So we read this special maftir before Purim, and also a special haftarah, which is different. Traditionally, it's a haftarah about revenge, and in the liberal tradition, it's a haftarah about how do we deal with other people, with enemies. So it could be that there are different haftarot in different congregations. And the Shabbat after Purim, Shabbat Para, where we read at Matthias a story of a sacrifice, of the burning of a red cow. This is a ritual which you do after you have had contact with dead. And on Purim, we had a lot of contact with dead because we read all the killing of the people. So we have to prepare for Pesach now and to be clean again. And we study about this purification text.
For the next massacre.
For you to know, the most important page in your blue Siddur is page 120. There is the navigation system, what you could do on Purim. Perhaps if you open it and let this page just open in front of you. Purim is not mentioned here. These are introductory texts, but then when you go to page 146 at the bottom, then you see on Hanukkah and Purim and Yom HaAtzmaut, Al Hanisim is inserted. So actually it's not much to learn. The Siddur tells you what to do.
it's the same insertions, the Alanism, you have in the Birkat HaMazon intervention.
Right. And that's what I have to tell you about Purim. Experience the day soon. I just want to give you something to think about. We all enjoy to have Purim. It's fun, great fun. But when you look at the perhaps as kids we enjoyed it, and now it's a bit the day is very problematic because what do we commemorate? What do we remember on that day? Actually, that we survived, yes, but also that we did revenge on our enemies, so that we killed the others and not the others killed us. So do we really want this?
Can I just point out on page 120, what is written here at the top is there are collections or readings at the other pages which you can use the introduction on these special days. You don't need big introductions on Purim. That's what there's no. And there's also no collection like
and
that.
And you don't have time,
Purim.
But you have to make it
Yeah, but there's also no anthology of Purim texts. Mm. They're all for the other days.
Mm.
So it refers to those before you start the service. Right? But it's the same service as Purim.
Because the text is quite problematic. It's not only these aspects, but it's also other aspects that Esther, for example, assimilated completely and gave up her Jewish tradition to be at the court. I think next weekend we talk about a bit of the content. But because the text was problematic, in the liberal Jewish tradition, they tried to abolish Purim because of these problematic content, but also because of the service is quite not so aesthetic as the have all this noise and what should the others think when they come to synagogue on that day. So the people in the 19th century didn't feel happy about that. And then also they knew that, okay it's said in the text you should have Purim on that and that day, but now in modern biblical scholarship we know Esther is a fairy tale, so why should we remember a fairy tale? Actually, I heard on one Purim we had a study day in one of the synagogues where I was. And there was someone who said that it's very important to have Purim to express anger. So when we feel hurt or wounded, we need to have something where we can make jokes about it, where we can express and the feeling we would like to kill the others and not permanently be killed, that it's allowed on Purim to let out this anger, so that it's not a solution to just put it away, but to use it as a ventil for our feelings.
There is another aspect to it, and that is always the two go together. Very serious holidays together with Purim type things. You have Carnival and Fasatate.
Yeah.
High holidays and Simchat Torah.
Hmm.
And they're always grouped together in the play of the emotions, whatever the theme is. So the Purim in that sense belongs to Pesach.
Well, now in the 19th century, biblical scholarship was much about. They thought when something was a fact, it's fine. When it's not a fact, it's not important. And that was till the middle of last century that you thought something must have happened, otherwise I don't believe it. Today people think differently because, for example, a poem is not truth. It didn't happen. When you say, oh, the clouds are so wonderful red, they're not red. But poetry expresses a truth, expresses something very truthful, which you can't say otherwise. So today in biblical scholarship people would say, it doesn't matter what it is, it expresses a value or an idea, and what is that? So
can I say something about that?
Yes, of course.
I think it's, in a way it's not important if something happens or not, but it lives in our conscious and unconsciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So even if that means time, I don't know if it happens, but in my subconsciousness it lives as a reality.
This is already Maimonides in Moreh Nevuchim, who writes about this. When an angel appears in a biblical text, that is a sign that it is a dream or a vision, not a historical reality.
Mm.
And so people attacked him very hard for that. But he said, the story is not true because it actually happened in history. Mm. It's true because it conveys a true description of the reality we live in, mm-hmm. even if it's not historically happened.
Right.
So the Purim story as such has you recognize it emotionally,
mm-hmm.
And that's what's important. The story tells that way, and I call it sort of an idealized dream. You know,
mm-hmm.
imagine this Jewish, highly assimilated woman who becomes queen of this country. You know, and all the Jews in being persecuted. You know, imagine something would happen like this to us. You know. But it's also a cowboy story, black and white.
Yes. Yeah. Any other comments, questions to Purim, because we go on now.
Yeah, but you can just a little bit about Purim Katan, where you have the other one and two. What are customs with Purim Katan?
Actually, for us as Chazanim, it's not, because then we just postpone Purim for a month. The problem is that every 7 years,
you don't postpone Purim. What happens is Adar Sheni is a real Purim.
This is
a real Adar.
Right. And before the last month, you put another.
You add an extra month in.
Yeah. And it happens that this month is called Adar 1.
Adar Sheni is a real one.
And what do you do on
Purim?
Nothing.
But it's okay. I'm sure there are local customs. Yes,
there were local customs. There still are local customs. To have it a little bit of a day in which you do not say, for instance, Tachanun prayers, prayers of supplication, and so on. But it's very very minor. Not.
When is
it?
If you have two adults, the Purim comes Adar Sheni. And then on the same day, the 14th of Adar Rishon, you mark something.
And you need that because the moon year and the sun year are not identical. And if you wouldn't put in the month, you would have summer or something. Let's move on to Hanukkah. Hanukkah is a rabbinic day. In the Talmud, it says that we celebrate is not the right word because it's not a festival. What should I say? That we do Hanukkah. So that we have Hanukkah. Because there was a situation where somehow Greeks happened to be in the temple. It's not so they were there. And the temple was impure. And they wanted to illuminate the menorah and didn't have pure oil. And someone found a little bit of oil and used it, and oh wonder, it states they could use this oil for 8 days. This reminds of the story of Eliyahu when he visited a woman and she didn't have flour to bake, and then the jar didn't went empty. So it's actually an Eliyahu story transposed to Hanukkah. There is another tradition about Hanukkah. If we were Catholic, it would be a biblical festival, but as we are not, we don't have that book. The story in the book of Maccabees, which you, when you are interested to read that, buy a Catholic Bible, or there's now a good translation of the Septuagint
in
English.
They are here in the Siddurim.
And some of them are also in the Siddurim. I gave you the pages, page 400. But it's big books, two books of the Maccabees. And the story there is, that the Greeks were there, and most of the Jews liked Hellenistic culture with the sports and everything the Greeks did. And a small group said, no, we should not assimilate. We should keep to our old Jewish tradition. And they made a rebel. They fought a military with military power against the Greeks, and they won. And you should not forget that day. This is a commemoration of them. They rededicated the temple.
It's all
in the book of Maccabees, but we don't know that. Officially, we don't know that, okay? So that's because some other people preserved that book. Otherwise, we would not know that story. Because the rabbis in the time would have experiences with what happens when you rebel against, not the Greeks, but Romans. because there were two battles when they fought against the Roman, and the first result was the temple was destroyed. The second result was in the Bar Kokhba revolt, that Jerusalem was forbidden for Jews, Talmud, Torah study was forbidden. So the rabbis have learned, when we teach this, it leads to really big catastrophes. So we should not teach that we should rebel against the political forces, but there was Hanukkah. So how to celebrate Hanukkah? So they said, well, the thing in Hanukkah is that nobody gave up hope. It was difficult times, and they had hope that this oil would last. So I hope you see that the mood of Hanukkah changed completely with the rabbis. And now, in our days, we are back more to this aspect.
So why didn't they change the story of wine then?
No, they're different. What just said is basic. You recognize this. First, the story of the oil is much later. It's not there in the beginning. There was no menorah, first of all, it had been taken away. You know, so how could they light it? They used seven spears, you know, they tells you. And you want the miracle. If you look at the... how do you know that the oil was kosher? I mean, they found bottle with oil. How do you know kosher was? It was right then, it was sealed?
Yes.
Okay. So, whose seal was on that bottle? The high priest. Who was the high priest? He was a Greek who was appointed by the Greeks who robbed the temple. If anybody you couldn't be trusted there was the high priest. And you use his kosher sign for the oil. The story doesn't fit. That's not important, because the message of the story is fine. And that's what we use. Okay? Now, and the second thing you see is the Haftarah for Shabbat Chanukah. Zobachayim. Not by might, not by power, but by my spirit. That's the text they chose to read this Haftarah. That's a text which is on the menorah outside the Knesset, on the lower arms also. Don't trust military might. So, very consciously, they took away the military aspect. That's why the books of Maccabees did not come into the canon of the Tanakh. Take away all the military stuff. Be pacifist. And Judaism state pacifist. Go to a synagogue, pray, do mitzvot, study. That's the way to bring the Mashiach. Not by going after Bar Kokhba. And it stayed that way. It stayed that way until the first Zionists came up and nationalism came in. And now we are in the same kind of tension, exactly that they were at that time, between the pacifism or do you fight? Yeah. Which one do we have? It's very hard, and you see the same kind of discussions and the same kind of fears about the country as was in those days. But 300 years of bloodshed in the one thing after the other, you know, ending in the pacifism. Purim is a very different story.
Better ask about Shoftim. Joshua.
And also another...
Purim has no messianic message in that sense. This was messianic fervor. We are going to kick the goyim out. We're going to win this war. We are going to fight to bring the Mashiach. Right? And the fighting to bring the Mashiach was it. There's no fighting for the Mashiach in the Purim.
And the messianic aspect, the Messiah, that... is actually the original Hanukkah is a postponed Sukkot. Because in the book of the Maccabees, it said they couldn't celebrate Sukkot when at the time of Sukkot, because the temple wasn't ritually clean. But as soon as they purified the temple again, the first they did was to celebrate Sukkot, and therefore Hanukkah is 8 days, as Sukkot is. Therefore, we have Hallel, as we do on Sukkot, the full Hallel, and therefore also the messianic aspects, because Sukkot is actually that we, in Birkat HaMazon, we have please rebuild the fallen house of David, which is the temple. So Sukkot has some aspects of temple dedication and rebuilding of the temple. So Hanukkah and Sukkot is related. And I didn't have a slide for that, but I also could have a slide. Hanukkah is connected to Roman, Greek, winter changing
solstice time.
That means that, and I think I the symbolic meaning is interesting, is great. That in the darkest, in the days of Hanukkah is new moon. When the moon is completely gone, and it's in December, it's the longest night of the year, because of the it gets early, quite dark, quite early, and again, day starts very late. So it's the darkest night of the year. And what would do we do? We could do two things. The one thing would be, oh dear, it's so dark, we can't work, the council, who will live? It's terrible. Or we light a light. And you see that one little candle can has such an effect. When it's really dark, to not sit there and meditate about the darkness, but do something, light a light. That's also an aspect of Hanukkah, but it's a Roman week.
They're so clever, the Jews. When it gets dark,
no, that was the Romans.
it goes back to the sun, which is sick, and you need to help it to get better. So you light up the lights. Light festivals in all peoples, all cultures in that time of year to help the sun. You see, it works.
Also, the body.
Any comments, questions to Hanukkah?
You had the word that I didn't understand.
Solstice.
That's when the period changed. So the, when the
solstice is the shortest day and the longest night.
Yeah, and that's something to do with the earth.
It doesn't get lighter again.
I can't.
It has something to do with the earth, with the planets.
The winter is from that for back, huh? It's a new one.
A technical one on Earth, maybe. I'm confused. The story of the Maccabees is from the 2nd century BC, isn't it?
About, 160.
And it was Titus who conquered the menorah. So there was a menorah. Getting things mixed up?
There were about 150 different menorahs in different times. They were robbed, they were taken away, they were remade, there were several
in Salomo's temple, but there were even 7 or 8 or so.
Yes.
It doesn't play a role in the Maccabee story, so it may be there, it may not be there. The Maccabees were not interested in that. It doesn't. If read the books of Maccabees, it's all about battle, fighting,
it's a good
conversation.
Before we move on, just a little break. Hanukkah is about a dedication of a temple. What would you say is the when you understand temple as a symbol for something? For what could it symbolize today? Because we have to do something with the tradition today. So what does temple stand for you?
It's a soul.
The
soul. We have in ourselves a little
temple
too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm waiting for the right answer.
Just
say
the inner house. Yeah. The inner house. Nefesh. I mean, your own internal experience that's coming out.
Yes, like a sitting body with your nefesh as a holy of holies, and you have the temple with the tabernacle, also with the holy of holies.
I just ask these questions because when we perform services, the text has to have to mean something to us. And when we do something which we don't understand, and later we come to the temple again and remember what you think is the temple. Somehow the temple is the place where God and Israel meet. So it's a symbol of God's presence, somehow. It's also a symbol of Jewish tradition, because it's all the sacrifices, and it's God's presence, Jewish tradition, and whatever you think. We could do a whole weekend about what could the temple mean. But keep something in mind. Think about it. What is the temple? We need that later on some other slides.
But Petrucham is not in the temple.
No.
It's a Petrucham. It's Petrucham.
Yeah,
Yeah, it's so that I can dwell among those who are building the temple. Yeah, not in the temple, but in the relationship with the people.
Just short summary: all Chanukah and Purim are about we were in danger, we survived, and now there's something to celebrate. Liturgically, it's normal weekday services, but with Al Hanissim and on Chanukah we have Hallel after the Amidah, and on Purim we have the reading of the Megillah. And now this new day, Yom HaAtzmaut, can be put parallel to Chanukah and Purim, because it's also something about we survived, and we were saved, and there was a miracle, and now let's celebrate. Yeah. Therefore, in your Sidur, do you have Hallel in there?
You have
Hallel, and you right, but I did that on another slide.
Yes.
That's the minor. You treat it as if it would be like Chanukah and Purim,
yeah,
and
yeah,
if the message is we were in danger, we survived, and that's something to celebrate.
Notice when you say we have Hallel, it is a Hallel for which you say the Baracha. If you don't say the Baracha, Hallel is just a collection of psalms. The moment you say the Baracha for the Hallel, it becomes a celebration of a holiday. So it raises. We had that discussion in practice when you had celebrations of Yom HaAtzmaut, things together, days past, and then this discussion, if we say Hallel or half Hallel, is it with the Bracha or without the Bracha? The big fights were about that Bracha.
Because
still going on. But I think the Israeli chief rabbinate says you say it with the Bracha. So they have raised, it's the first Jewish holiday to be added in 2,000 years. Something.
So let's have a quick look at Yom HaAtzmaut. The day started 1948, because that was when the Declaration of Independence was pronounced on the 5th of Iyar, which was in that time the 14th of May. And it is on the 5th of Iyar if it's not Shabbat. If Shabbat is the 5th Iyar, it's somehow the day close to that, the Monday after it, or Thursday. Or
Thursday before. Mm. Also if it's on Friday.
Yeah, right. And sometimes there are synagogues who have Shabbat Atzmaut when it's in the weekend, but you can't do anything during the week because the people work and so, and then you have some Yom HaAtzmaut aspect on Shabbat, but it's not Yom HaAtzmaut on that Shabbat, it's just the Shabbat after that. And it's preceded by a day, Yom HaZikaron, where you have memorial events for the fallen soldiers, the Israeli fallen soldiers. In Israel, it's celebrated as the Independence Day with official political speeches and events and lighting of torches for the 12 tribes. So it's a big political event. And now, liturgically, should this day impact our prayers? I think this is something it's worth to think about, because when we do this, we would say Yom HaAtzmaut has religious aspects. Some say, as the Dutch tradition, that it's a day like Chanukah and Purim. We celebrate survival. Others say it's a day like Pesach. It's also about survival, but it's also to become free. So there is a tradition that you have a kind of Haggadah for Israel Independence Day. And if you have never seen something like this, I brought some examples. For example, this is a Yom HaAtzma'ut Haggadah or Israel Independence Haggadah, and they have four cups in the story. And if you are interested, come and have a look at it after the lecture. Or there are also groups, just to not forget them, who say that's not a special day at all, because it is not a religious day, for several reasons. Or they say it's actually a fast day and we have to mourn because it's a sin to have a state. So at the moment it's very unclear what to do.
They were invited to Milan.
Well, yes, remember what happened, we just talked about the miracle of the oil and the pacifism. Mm. They are the ones who keep that within its tradition. Don't fight for the state. Therefore, the fight with the army and everything Israel in that sense stands for is wrong. Yeah. The Mashiach should bring us back. Now we bring the Mashiach by our prayers, by our study, by our mitzvot. That's the way to do it. So what we have is really a break with that whole long pacifist tradition. So you can't just say they are crazy. They are consistent with the long rabbinic tradition. We are not. We have been influenced by the 19th century European nationalism and a creation of nation states. That's a new idea. Okay. And it's secular, it's not religious.
Yeah.
And the people who built Israel were all the anti-religious Zionists who did God's work when in the Shoah all the prayers of the best chazanim in the world didn't help. They saved Judaism. Mm-hmm. You know, it's another aspect to it. Mm-hmm. But to say that these people are crazies, be careful.
I think I always say, like to emphasize here, especially in the Gulag, that if Israel wasn't there, we wouldn't be sitting here so comfortably.
Of course.
I said that.
Of course.
And if I go
to
shake hands with Ahmadinejad, they are crazy.
Yeah.
Okay.
I said they are consistent with the old rabbinic tradition.
And I think for us it's important to know what the world does. So what
he
other people
say
do.
He didn't say he wanted to Jews. He said he wants to get rid of Israel. And that's consistent with that ideology. Ahmadinejad has nothing against Jews. There are many Jews in Iran. And most of them
nothing against Jews.
No, yeah.
It's an important distinction to make. It's an important distinction to make. You know, Jews have all the rights within the Muslim world, as long as they, you know, keep to their place and don't try to be upstarts and have something to say themselves. You know, the Dimis have a right to live. Be careful with what you say, because otherwise they'll catch you on mistakes in that sense. Yeah. I'm no friend of Adam Ahmadinejad, nor of Tore Kata. You know, but when you talk about them, realize, you know, what I'm saying, they are not crazies in that sense. There is a consistent ideology which is old, which is a serious representation of what Judaism stands for, and you've got to respect that even if you disagree with it.
There's a very good book by Ahmadinejad about the ultra-Orthodox connection or point of view in terms of Zionism. Some are anti-Zionistic, some are not anti-Zionistic. It's a very, very interesting book where you spell out all the ideology and the long tradition that
you
have.
To be recommended.
And I think we have now 2 months, to prepare Yom HaAtzma'ut among all the other days. And you can also use this time to study the texts, and you find on page 120 where the texts are, and it says it's on 468 and following pages. Use the time to study, to read the text, study them, try to understand them, to think what's my opinion. We have to do what our synagogues want us to do, but we also have to have our... I once led a service, and afterwards came someone came to me and said that I led the prayer to, as if I would say, well, don't care what it means, just trust. So that even if you have doubts about something, you can, it's okay to bring it in, but you have to have somehow a position and not just say, well, we have to do this. And it's much more intensive when you say, yeah, it's something to celebrate and I stand behind it. It would be different if you just say, well, it's your heart mode, let's do it. I just want to mention one day which I wasn't asked to talk about, but just that you know that it exists. There's also a Yom Yerushalayim, and some people have a Seder Yom Yerushalayim that commemorates the day that Jerusalem was unified after the Six-Day War, and it's now a unified city. But we don't talk about that. Don't you have a Seder Yom Yerushalayim?
Well, no, we don't. It's interesting because Orthodoxy has a problem with Yom HaTzmaut. But they do celebrate Yom Yerushalayim. Secular people have no problem with Yom HaTzmaut, but they may have a problem with Yom Yerushalayim because it's so nationalistic. there is a discrepancy between the two.
Yeah, I think it's quite clear. Chanukah, Purim, Yom HaTzmaut. Any final questions to these? So this first block of dates, which we just talked about.
I just want to mention Tubishvat.
Right. I also thought about that. Yeah, that Tubishvat has some aspects also of this. It could belong to that, because today, although it has different roots, it has roots in a very mystical, Kabbalistic, but today Tubishvat often has aspects of, let's think about the land of Israel and eat food from there. So, yeah.
It's actually New Year, isn't it?
It's a New Year celebration, yeah. And therefore you have a Haggadah because it's a New Year. And, yeah.
Agricultural
Now we go to the second column, and the mood will change completely. We come from this joyous festival to Tisha B'Av. Which is connected, as it has something to do with the temple as Hanukkah, it has something to do with catastrophes as Purim, as Yom HaTzmaut also. On Tisha B'Av, the Mishnah teaches, the following five things happened, and this is what we should remember. So Tisha B'Av is a festival that was... The origin is in the Mishnah, but the events are biblical events. It was on Tisha B'Av that it was decreed that the generation of the desert, so after the after the scouts said, we don't manage to go into the land, it's too difficult, and God decreed on that day, on Tisha B'Av, okay, you don't have to enter the land. Stay in the desert, die in the desert, the next generation will get into the land. That was on Tisha B'Av. Second event, the first temple built by Solomon was destroyed by the Babylonians on Tisha B'Av. Third event, the second temple, this is the first temple, the second temple built by the Romans was partly also by the Romans, but it was also destroyed by the Romans. They used it to make big attacks. The fourth event is that Betal, that was a city where lots of Jews lived, and in the Bar Kokhba revolt, that was the last Jewish stronghold that was destroyed, and the Bar Kokhba revolt was even worse than the temple destruction. Because after that, the Romans forbid to study Torah, and you know the story, the martyrdom of Akiva, and so that was all after Bar Kokhba. So Bar Kokhba was a real catastrophe. Judaism was forbidden. And then the Mishnah, for example, started because people thought we have to write down our tradition. So this really led into a completely disastrous catastrophe. This is also Bar Kokhba, that the Romans really said Jerusalem is forbidden for Jews.
So then no Tisha B'Av is the reason for the pessimistic stuff.
No,
because here are the moments that revolts led to disaster.
That's what we learned from that. Yeah.
Well, the first temple, the second temple, and everything around from the Maccabees until Bar Kokhba, in that period, 165, 435 after, was a period of total one rebellion after the other. And if you realize that we celebrate the Maccabees, but the people who brought the Romans in were the grandchildren of the Maccabees, because they were the kings and they were fighting and they called in the Romans, and the Romans chose the side of the weaker of the two and took over the country. So they lost what they won.
Tisha B'Av attracted somehow other negative events. On Tisha B'Av, King Edward issued the edict expelling all Jews from England. In 1492, Jews were expelled. That was the final date when Jews had to leave Spain, and the Jewish life in Spain ended. And 1942, it was the day when Jews were deported from the Warsaw Ghetto, and was the end of the Warsaw Ghetto.
It's the day when the Prince Ferdinand was killed in Sarajevo, and the First World War started. Tisha B'Av. Which led to the Second World War, which led to the Shoah. It was a fatal shot.
Oh my God, Friday is 13th is nothing compared to this.
Tisha B'Av has even more impact on the liturgy as Purim. The Shabbat before Tisha B'Av is Shabbat Chazon. That's when we read Isaiah's vision of God in the temple.
Kadosh.
It's the chapter one, Isaiah one. I come to that later. I just want to show you the frame. So before Tisha B'Av, we have the Shabbat where we read rebukes, and so you left God, you worshipped other idols, so you did that and that and that and that, the prophet said. So it's no surprise that after that Tisha B'Av comes. That's the logical consequence. But after Tisha B'Av, it's also somehow logical, we have Shabbat Nachamu, where we read Isaiah 40, Nachamu, Nachamu Ami, comfort, comfort my people, says God. And after that, front of it first, before Shabbat Chazon, we have actually three haftarot of admonition. They are also called Tzatzat de Pu'anuta, that's the Aramaic word. And these are two haftarot from Jeremiah, and I don't know if you know the book of Jeremiah, it has really harsh text. It says that Israel is like a woman who abandoned her husband and went with other men, and so Israel adored other gods, and it's really hard text. They have to watch in that time, in 3 weeks.
Why is it always the woman that leaves the husband? Yeah. The woman.
Yeah. Why do they do that?
If you're interested in that, that's an interesting question in biblical scholarship, the role of women in the prophets, because it was the beginning of some very negative consequences in understanding. It's a good... If you're interested, that's much to do with study.
They kicked them out.
After Shabbat, so Shabbat Chazon is the end of these three haftarot of admonition. Shabbat Nachamu is the beginning of seven haftarot of comfort. So you should notice that it's three against seven. And seven is completeness. So there is complete comfort and only three admonitions.
But do also tell them that Jeremiah is the worst of the prophets of doom. He's also the greatest comforter afterwards when it actually happened. It's a fantastic text.
The admonition starts with a day that is not kept in the liberal tradition, the 17th of Tammuz, which is a minor fast day. Minor means you don't fast from the beginning of the day till the end, because that would mean that you start in the evening when it gets dark and do it till it gets dark again. On the minor days, you start fasting in the morning. So you have an evening meal, you sleep, and then you don't have breakfast and then start to fast. And so it's not a full 25-hour day. And the seventh haftarot of comfort, they lead to Rosh Hashanah. Therefore, it's it's important that in this period of time, sometimes you have you don't read the Haftarah, for example, to I think for example by Yitzhak, or but you have to take care that you have 1, 2, 3 Tisha B'Av, and then 1 till 7 Rosh Hashanah. Therefore, sometimes it's tricky that you have to write in that period, and you have to be aware not to read to mix it up.
Can I add to this? We have the 3-year cycle, and we have also in that cycle we have a 3-year cycle of Haftarot. But you will notice that the Haftarot that are tied to the calendar like this are the same every year. And only the ones that are not tied to the calendar, but to the Sidra, they vary. But these are all the same. Like runs round Purim, Pesach also are also the same every year.
So what do you do after your reading after?
You look in the list.
Yeah, just be
just
aware.
Just be aware that after, why some have got to be a change and why some don't.
You have to concentrate on which Haftarah to read.
So the question, what you mean is, do they replace the regular Haftarah?
Yes.
Yes.
They do replace the regular Haftarah.
Just like we did last Saturday, Malachim 8 instead of Malachim 5.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm.
This is also the period around the Shabbat.
Before.
Yeah, but that's something different. But these are the 3 weeks leading to Tisha B'Av.
3 weeks before Tisha B'Av, you don't get married.
Yes. Rosh Hashanah, as you all know, and I'll talk about that, leads to Yom Kippur, of course, and in the middle we have Zom Gedaliah, which is another small fast day, which commemorates the assassination of Gedaliah, which was someone, the Babylonians, installed, and the killing of Gedaliah actually then led to the exile.
But the Reform don't stick to the non-marrying before
Unless there is specific reason to do it in those weeks, but if there is not, then we avoid it. Yes. same as in the over period, you know, if it's not necessary, plan it in a way that you know.
Yeah.
Is there somehow a connection or relation to 10 days of the Shua and 10 weeks from special after all?
Oh, interesting. I don't know.
Is there somehow a relation?
Yes,
there
right.
There are 10 days
right,
of Shua and 10 weeks of really special Haftarot. Right. Is there somehow a relation between them?
I think so.
Or is that coincidence?
I think you are the first to notice.
Is that a coincidence?
Interesting.
So
there are 10 days of the Shua.
And 10 special
Haftarot. I see.
And 10 weeks of special Haftarot.
Do you know any? Is that
coincidence?
No, I know that.
It's a good observation.
The idea of the 3 and 7 add to 10, that is quite clear, that there is a 10 week period of special Haftarot. But I thought it was always that it was this combination of 3 and 7, the 3 imperfect ones and the 7 perfect ones.
And I think that 10 here has something to do with Rosh Hashanah, it's the Babylonian. The Babylonian New Year festival has a day of 10, so they have 10 periods of 10. So I thought it comes from there.
It's sort of it's a problem with the development, because Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur was a part of the Sukkot thing, and it was separate
right.
later on.
Right.
So,
and I just added another small fast day. Now let me explain what all these fast days are. On the 10th of Tevet, the Babylonians began to occupy Jerusalem. On the 17th of Tammuz, the walls were, they broke through the walls. On Tisha B'Av, they destructed the temple. Here, on that fast day, is the assassination of Gedaliah, and Sukkot has this aspect of messianic hope. The temple will, in the messianic time, will be rebuilt. You can also understand it in a different way and see these stories. That on 17th of Tammuz, the rabbis teach, actually that was the day when Moses came from Sinai, heard the noise, and saw, oh, they made a golden calf, and he smashed the tablets. On Tisha B'Av was the decree that this generation will not enter the land. On Yom Kippur, on that first of Tishri, Moses came again from Sinai having the new tablets. And you know, at the end of Sukkot, we start a new cycle of Torah reading. So it's a new start. In the liturgy of Yom Kippur, we have this Hashem, Hashem, El Rachum, V'chanun, which comes from the story of the golden calf, that God forgives this sin. And where it says, forgive as you said, Salachti, that comes from the story of the scouts. So both these stories have an influence on Yom Kippur. So it's all somehow connected liturgically.
One question, what other source than the Mishnah do we have that all those events occurring on Tisha B'Av from your first sheet, not the second sheet?
Yeah.
What other sources except Mishnah we have?
You mean that on the first destruction of the front, destruction?
Yeah, the first destruction of the Book of Kings. But does it say?
Yeah, but it doesn't say, no, it doesn't say that.
No,
that Tisha B'Av.
It says on the 10th of the, according to the Book of Kings, the temple was destroyed on the 10th of the month, not on the 9th of the month, and therefore, The Karaite Jewish sect, commemorates the destruction of the temple on the 10th of Av and not on the 9th of Av.
You have it's a miracle, or it's a construction afterwards.
Mm.
Yeah.
It happened on the same day. It was the same Ahmad, the same watch of the Kohanim, people from people who were there, same people, same group. It happened the same time of the day, in the same sequence, two identical events. The destruction of the first temple and the destruction of the second temple. So you can, it was a repeat performance. Well, I don't know if that's historically correct, but it links the two, because the first one set the whole halachic process, first element of democratization of getting what became the Pharisees. That process started, and it reached fruition at the destruction of the second temple. Then this tradition began. The first one took over at the second one. So you have a whole development period marked by those two events.
Tisha B'Av is like a negative counterpart to Yom Kippur. So the day is experienced in the same way. You fast from the evening of the day, so when it starts to get dark, you start the fast, and you break it when it's dark again. But it's actually much more difficult than Yom Kippur, because on Yom Kippur you can't go to the kitchen anyway, because you sit in the synagogue praying. But on Tisha B'Av it's a normal working day, so you pass all the shops, and then to keep a fast much harder than
and the day
before.
Is longer.
Huh?
And the day is longer.
It's longer.
And the day is
longer.
Right.
And it's warmer.
Remember,
can
a fast day.
Can we, because I don't have so much time.
What one sentence?
A lot of one sentence.
A fast day is a tzum, which means you don't drink. It's not eating, it's okay. Okay, very good. Yeah, okay. But the emphasis is on not drinking.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about the middle of the summer.
Mm.
Yeah, and then the heat.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's just to remind you what you don't do on Yom Kippur. So no eating, no drinking, no washing, no bathing, no application of creams, oils, wearing leather shoes, or sexual relations. Then in the services, in the evening service and the morning service, we sit on low stools on the floor. Normally, there is no Torah study, so if you do regular Torah study, not on that day.
Shiva chairs.
Except we read Echa and we chant Kinot. And the synagogue is not, sometimes the parochet is put away, and no, it's really like a naked synagogue, so it's without any decoration.
Okay.
To symbolize, it's not there, it's destroyed. So we sit in something that is ruined.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Jewelry is allowed on Yom Kippur?
It's what?
Jewelry.
On Yom Kippur?
Yeah.
Yom Kippur?
I think it depends on the congregation. There are discussions that you should not. You mean earrings and
But don't you tear your clothes into Shabbat?
There may be people who introduce other elements of mourning.
No,
no, but the main thing, I never heard of it, but it, that doesn't mean anything.
There is also a movement that is saying that it's because we have now the state of Israel, Shabbat can be a little bit
weaker. And I come to the next It's one of the things where I would say, think about it. The idea behind Tisha B'Av, and it's related to Yom Kippur, is that because of our sin, we lost the temple and the land. And we pray for forgiveness, which means, God, bring us back to our land. So in the land, you would also have to think, do we have to say we sinned and therefore we are expelled? We are not expelled, we are there. So this is connected, and this is a really problematic point today. It wasn't in medieval times. So during the whole medieval period, that was quite clear for people, and they didn't feel something strange. But today, especially after the Shoah, it opened our eyes to say, well, this is a catastrophic thinking, to think like this. The Talmud teaches, and for example, last year in my congregation in London, this was the most important teaching on Tisha B'Av. So the Shoah was not mentioned at all, which I found really strange, because I was used that this is a day where you commemorate the Shoah. But in the congregation in London, that was the event that people commemorated. And it's a story that is so brilliant that I have to tell you. The rabbis say that Jerusalem was destroyed because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. That is the reason why God's presence. We lost the symbol of God's presence, we lost the symbol of Jewish tradition because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. What happened? A certain man who had a friend named Kamsa and an enemy, listen carefully, named Bar Kamsa. This man made a banquet and he told his attendant, go and bring Kamsa to join me at the banquet. The attendant somehow didn't listen carefully and went and mistakenly brought him Bar Kamsa. When the host arrived at the banquet and found Bar Kamsa sitting there, he said to Bar Kamsa, look here, that man is the enemy of that man. What do you think you want to do here? Go out. And Bar Kamsa said to him, since I now have come and I was invited actually, let me stay, and I will give you the value of what I drink and eat, so you don't have to, it shouldn't be an invitation. The host said to Bar Kamsa, no, you should not stay. Bar Kamsa said to him, I will give you the value of the banquet, half the value of the banquet. And the host said to him, no. Bar Kamsa said, I will give you the value of the complete banquet. And the host said, no. He grabbed hold of Bar Kamsa with his hands, stood him up, and ejected him. Bar Kamsa said to himself, all the rabbis were sitting in that banquet, and nobody rebuked him for the way he treated me. And is this event what he did? Obviously, it was acceptable to them. So then, now I will go and spread splendor against the rabbis in the royal palace, as he went to the Roman ruler, and now the story continues, and he said a lot of things, and in the end, Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans. And that is, Jerusalem was destroyed because of faceless hatred. I think the story is so, I mean, you smile, I mean, we all know that, especially in a congregation where we know each other so well. And what this story tells us is that exactly this behavior leads to the destruction of God's presence among us. So be really careful, this is serious. But let's go back to the liberal position. In liberal Judaism, people said, we do not observe Tisha B'Av because we mourn the loss of the temple. But actually we don't mourn that we don't have a temple, because the temple was the beginning of that we have prayers. So it was the beginning of rabbinic Judaism, which was better than the sacrificial cult. So we are actually happy that the temple, it was a period in the history, it was good, and we progressed further. So you can meet many Reform rabbis who don't observe Tisha B'Av. So just don't be surprised when it's Tisha B'Av and someone goes in a restaurant to demonstrate, I'm not keeping this day. This is a way of keeping it, to say no. In recent years, it became a memorial day for Jewish catastrophes, and among them the Shoah. But there again, I would say, think, because it's a memorial day for a lot of catastrophes. And is the Shoah like the destruction of the temple and like the expelling of Spain? So is it just one in a chain of many? Or is it really special? It's just think what you do. When you do this, you send a message to people. It's not just you create a meaning by doing that.
And there is a movement, again, within the stricter orthodoxy, to put Yom HaShoah, don't accept Yom HaShoah, but to remember Shoah in Tisha B'Av, make it part of that. That may happen in another 50 or 100 years, when the distance to the Shoah has come, that they will bundle it also together, like the others have been bundled in. But it's too early.
You know already page 120, you have introductory text, so on a service, evening service, morning service on Tisha B'Av, how to start, how you could start that with some readings. And then the readings are on page 490 and 503.
You find the historical build-up there also.
And next weekend we will talk about how to read. Will we talk how to read Lamentations? If you want to have an experience of Tisha B'Av and your congregation doesn't do it, there is in summer the Jewish Christian Bible Week of Leo Beck College, and later I pass this around. Which Tisha B'Av is in the week we study, and we study the Book of Echa. So it would be an opportunity to study the Book of Echa and to experience Tisha B'Av liturgically, because we have a service on the day where we read the Book of Echa. So if you want to experience this or also do something, for example, if you would say, I would like to read a chapter of Lamentations, let me know, because I'm part of the organizing team, and then we could integrate practicing in that evening. Later I will just pass it around and then perhaps write down the website.
Interesting experience.
Then also in the Yom Sidur, just before the Nichamocha, after the Shema, the Dorotenu.
Yeah,
and that's on the son on Echa.
That is Rubens.
Yeah,
the text is new.
Yeah,
text, we made the text here. In that emet, to integrate the historical, it's a historical experience. It starts from the Egypt and the Shira, and we included both the Shoah and Israel in that part. So Reuben put it to the music of Tisha B'Av and of I think it's only used in the Hague.
And it wasn't over.
The last day we have to talk about now in this lecture is Yom HaShoah. The Hebrew name spelled with one spelling mistake. It's Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura, which means Yom of the Shoah and of our strength. It was introduced in 1951. By the Knesset as the official Holocaust Remembrance Day.
Let me elaborate on that a little bit.
1951, the idea was to create the create Yom HaShoah on the 10th of Tibet, since it was a fast day. And that was the suggestion of the rabbinate and Misrada that taught, especially of a man by the name of Shlomo Zalman Kahana, who did all sorts of tricks with the calendar and with the... I'm not going to read it. So that for a while was accepted. But then in 1966, the Knesset did not... the religious parties were very much for it, for the 10th of Tevet to become Yom HaShoah. The non-religious parties, the seculars, were dead set against that because, they, first of all, they want to dissociate it from the religious meaning of the Asara B'Tevet. Second, the idea of a commemoration of the Shoah was considered a degradation for Israeli pride. What do you mean? We need to celebrate the Gevurah, the heroism, not the going like sheep to the slaughter, but wherever there was heroism. And where was there heroism? In the Warsaw Ghetto. The Warsaw Ghetto was heroism. So the idea was to commemorate the Shoah on the day of the revolt of the Warsaw Ghetto. Unfortunately, the revolt of Warsaw Ghetto not only did not succeed, but also was on the eve of Pesach. And you couldn't celebrate Yom HaShoah on Passover Eve. That was impossible. So what did they do? In 1966, they figured out on that particular day what was the non-Jewish calendar day of the revolt. And in 1966, that day coincided with the 27th of Nisan. And this is how Yom HaShoah was fixed. Yom HaShoah Bar Gvura.
Why wasn't the photo
of the Shoah? This is the listing that the non-religious Zionists wanted to associate. They wanted to associate it not with a destruction of the temple, but with heroism. Now we have a different approach. Totally, that has changed completely in Israel. We do recognize Yom HaShoah as Shoah. As not, at that time, people were ashamed of the word Shoah. People were ashamed that Jews went to the slaughter. As a matter of fact, the survivors who came to Israel suffered from there. You went like sheep to the slaughter. You didn't fight.
There was also, I asked the question then, I let you
know. No, yeah,
okay, so let's see, Owen.
So, can you repeat why it wasn't the 14th of December that they chose, I understand, because it was the East Pesach, so why did it become 27th?
So they just calculated.
They calculated.
In 1966, it all happened in 1966. The day, the 2nd of May, was the 27th of Nisan, and that's how it was fixed.
So instead of taking 43 days of 66. I think you said it, that the Shoah as a word, like a Hebrew word, the meaning of Shoah doesn't mean Holocaust, because Holocaust is much weaker as of what happened than Shoah. But what is the meaning of Shoah as a word?
Yeah, let me say something to that. Elie Wiesel introduced the word Holocaust. It's a Greek word, and it's used in the Greek translation, the Septuagint, for Ola. For Ola, that's when you sacrifice a whole animal. What's the...
Burnt offering.
And the idea that Elie Wiesel had originally was that when Isaac was bound on the altar and almost was a burnt offering, and he said that in the Shoah he became a burnt offering. So Isaac is the Jewish people, and it was actually a burnt offering. Okay? And then people thought and said, okay, it's a burnt offering. So who was the priest? Who was it offered for? Who was it brought for? Because it's when it's a sacrifice, someone sacrifices for some. So you see that the verse is very problematic. Did the Nazis, were the Nazis the priest? And was it for God? No, the verse is completely senseless. And Elie Wiesel himself regretted deeply that he introduced that word. Mm-hmm. The word Shoah comes from Jeremiah somewhere, and it means complete destruction. Mm-hmm. With no meaning. It's just a complete destruction.
An ultimate catastrophe.
Yeah.
So if you would translate it, you would say, is there like a one word for complete destruction that you could replace the Holocaust for?
Shoah. In liturgy, we have to think about how to express meaning and feelings. And at the moment we are really close to this event. So it's one of the days where it's not clear what to do. And in different countries, in the United States, in England, it's different from what you hear here in Holland or in Israel, because people bring different experiences which have to be expressed differently liturgically. One group of people say, we have something on Yom HaShoah with a Megillah. Again, if you have never seen it, this is Megillat HaShoah, which is done by conservative groups, conservative movement in Israel and in America, in the United States. The idea of having a Megillah in a service means it's Purim, it's Tisha B'Av. Megillah says we were in danger, we survived. The original Megillah is Purim, is Esther. Yeah, there was a decree to kill us all, but we survived. And that's the first Megillah, and then we had the Megillah on Tisha B'Av, and the Megillah became also for Pesach, Sukkot, Shavuot, Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, to say, this we celebrate survival. So to celebrate survival, the best is to have a Megillah.
But what Megillah is it?
This is Megillat HaShoah. It's not.
But what's in there?
It's a new
Shoah story?
It's again, shall we pass it around now, or will you come and see
it?
It's the same kind of, it's a collection of texts.
Yeah.
And so yes, it's for liturgy and what you can do on the day.
Yeah.
And there are many, many of these things. We have in the Siddur also, you have the whole Shoah anthology, all texts, and there is a memorial service. You'll see it in a moment here.
Okay. And they have, for example, texts, it's a collection of texts, texts from the Bible. In the beginning, the earth is filled with chaos and confusion, the darkness, and it's text to different themes, but it's actually a collection of texts, which is read.
If you want, you have to put something together, you have a number of these books, and you look and you pick what you think this is going to present, what I want to say, what the message is.
The liberal synagogues in France, they produced a Sefer HaShoah, which has a big part in the middle, which is called Magid, which you know from the Pesach Haggadah. Mm-hmm. Then it has a memory about Amalek, so it's quite new. So it's again a collection of texts, but they don't call it Megillah, but and it's based on the structure of the Haggadah. Others say we can't use any form we have so far. We create something completely new. And when I did some research on what do people do on Tisha B'Av, I found that there was a midrash on the Holocaust by Bnei Brit Hillel Foundation, which is a new liturgical form. Again, it's also a kind of collection of texts. So actually, what they do is quite the same, but then the names are different.
What congregation is that one?
Bnei Brit Hillel, that's the Bnei Brit, the organization. So it's not a congregation, but it's, they publish it also. It's also, I
think.
Put it here. Here.
It's for the universities, university students and so on. They have all still the Hiller houses at the universities.
Yeah. Or you do a service with special reading rituals, but don't call it special name.
That's what we,
And as we already mentioned, there were other ideas how to, on what day to remember of the Shoah. So it could be Tisha B'Av, it could be 10th of Tevet, but we already heard that. Again, page 120, you are you see there's a hint that there are study text on page 480 and a memorial service on 442. Just remember page 120 and that leads you to the other text. Oh yeah, and there is also text for 4th of May, which is important for Holland. Just to summarize, because I'm at the end of what I wanted to tell you, Yom HaShoah and Yom HaAtzmaut are recent liturgical days. They are both in the progress of having an impact on the liturgy, but it's not quite clear what exactly to do. At the moment, there are many different possibilities, and it's again something to think about. We are in the process of developing liturgy. What do we want to express? Do we want to express something at all? What is our position? So when we do services on these days, they are demanding tasks to do. Any questions to these 2 days?
I have one question. That's for both of you to work. Now, the day of the liberation from Auschwitz has become a European or a general universal thing. We in Israel have experienced a very strange situation. The entire world it commemorates that day, but Israel does not, and because we have our own day of commemoration. And that creates some kind of a strange tension there. Is there an attempt in Jewish communities in Europe to do something on that day?
Have you noticed anything over that? Here we have, always on the last Sunday in January, the Auschwitz Memorial, and that has been, that's closest to the day when the Germans left and the Russians came in 10 days later. So 18th of January, I think, was the...
27th.
Yeah, but that was when the Russians came.
Oh, okay.
So that period is here marked every year for a generation already. And I don't think anybody feels for moving that to whatever United Nations now suggested. I haven't heard anybody talk about that or say anything about it or ask about it.
I'm afraid I have.
You do, yes?
We have that problem.
But you're
at the museum. Part in the Holland Schouwburg. And there we have Yom HaShoah, and we have the others, the 4th of May also. But many people, for example, the Auschwitz Committee and other committees and organizations in the Netherlands, also tend now to have a day on the 27th, and there are lectures and many things going on. So there is another extra day, and some of us think, oh my God. What do we do with that? Because it's
and. Mm-hmm. 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 That was the day that we had now also in January.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
In England, synagogues do concerts with composers. Or exhibitions with pictures. So the synagogues offer a program. And the city does also some, but that's parallel, but the synagogues also offer, it's quite parallel, that there's something from the floral plants that they have in the hall memorial, but and the Jewish listening also or something. In Germany, it's quite an important day because the politicians invite Jewish congregations to read something. We had discussions, shall we mourn, shall we do the memorial for the others? Because that was such an important day in Germany, and the Jewish congregations had to contribute, although it's not our Yom HaShoah. So the 27th of January became a strange day. In Berlin, there is a reading of names that all the people who... that the names are read, and every year they read the whole night, the names. And then there are many, many other days, like the 9th of November. And in the GDR, they had the local days.
Any number of memorials here also, of course. This way
happened. Which is actually the transition to the next slide, that what I experienced in Berlin was that all these events, which were not Pesach or Shavuot, were overshadowed by the Shoah, and any other additional day just added to that feeling that we have to somehow how to survive.
I know it from my American students that in America it seems that the Yom HaShoah now takes precedence over Yom HaTzmaut, and it becomes there's more and more commemoration of Yom HaShoah as we're going further away from Yom HaShoah. There is more emotional investment in Yom HaShoah than
This is interesting because this is the process which led to the writing of the Torah in Babylon, led to the writing of the Mishnah
and Talmud.
The Mishnah and then the Talmud, but first the Mishnah after the destruction of the Temple. We had here about 50 years after the Shoah an enormous flood suddenly of Shoah literature, people writing down. When you're afraid it's going to be forgotten, you start putting up all memorials and writing down the text and all these things not to forget. Remember. So what we see, Israel is there. Israel is a fact, and it's there, and nobody's really afraid. That something will happen to it seriously, more than war ever is. It's so awful. But then the Shoah is under pressure, and when you get these hoaxes going on the internet saying that in England they're forbidden the teaching of Shoah on the schools. You have here some Moroccan kids who go play with the flowers and one of the monuments, and the next year the whole city is full of Yom HaShoah memories, to make sure it stays there. So this is part of that kind of movement to make sure it's not forgotten.
Could it be so that because I don't think that the people are totally not afraid that something will happen to Israel. I think maybe that because people like Ahmadinejad call for a kind of Shoah in Israel, where other people, the Shoah as a warning, what can happen to Jews also in Israel, it becomes more and more important than the Day of Independence.
The generation who lived with the miracle of Israel, who had been there when there was no Israel, and you needed it so badly, that generation is almost gone. People now, Israel is a natural thing. It's just there, like it's always been there, in your own feeling, and therefore it relates differently. What's under threat is the memory of the Shoah, in that sense, at least in this surrounding, and with the when you hear about the problems in the schools of teaching Shoah, this stimulates more memorial efforts.
So in the next weekend we will deal with all these, not with this, but all the other days. I actually had also that table on a piece of paper I forgot to give you. If you need something to remember the structure.
If you go to page 120 in the Siddur.
What it doesn't have is, as we have the next something for Puri.
Tisha B'Av is also very fancy. If you go, even Tisha B'Av is fancy. Before next weekend, go to page 120, read the anthologies, and read them carefully. Feel the texture. And why these texts were chosen for this occasion.